You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is The Way We Live Now. Today is day 100 since most of us have had a routine checkup of any kind, and day 48 of this podcast. I've been thinking about all of our health beyond the anxiety of COVID. I mean, have any of us had a checkup, seen the dentist, had a colonoscopy or a mammogram? And what about those of us who were already contending with health issues or facing surgery? My guest today is Dr. Niamh Wilson, Director of Breast Surgery Quality and Research at the Hartford Healthcare Cancer Institute. Niamh, thank you so much for talking with me about the way we live now.
Absolutely. It is my pleasure to join you.
Describe for me where you are right at this very moment as we're speaking, as we're having this conversation. Just give me a sense of what you're looking at, where you're sitting.
So I'm actually upstairs in my closet, which thankfully is it's a nice sized closet. But I'm roaming around up here because I have a great Wi-Fi signal. And also my children can't get up here because there are several doors blocking us. And if I had those doors unlocked, I can guarantee that one of them, if not all three, would at some point come barging in here and want to take some of my shoes or use the bathroom or in some way just kind of be around me. So I've locked a couple of doors and my husband is helping babysit for this short period of time. But I'm looking out my backyard window and looking at all the various things that we've set up during this quarantine period for them to play with because they haven't really gotten to see their friends and everything, and just actually feeling very grateful for the nice weather we've been having and the fact that we have a nice backyard and everything for them.
Mm-hmm. By the way, you are not the only guest who I've spoken to from a closet or in a closet. I've also had several guests who have been in cars, like in cars outside their house so that they could
speak. I've done that. Yeah. I've taken conference calls out there. Mm-hmm. So.
This is the way we live now. So
absolutely.
When did you first realize the enormity of COVID-19? When did it really hit home for you as a physician, your husband as a physician as well? So I'm wondering in your household sort of when it became clear that this was coming and it was going to be huge.
I think my husband and I kind of caught on pretty early. I think there's two reasons for that. One is that a very close friend of mine from residency, general surgery trained, and my very, very close friend from residency, and I still keep in close contact. And that person is Robert Redfield's son, also by the same name, Robert Redfield. Actually, he's the third. So he and I would communicate, every so often. And as soon as I kind of heard some of these stories that were coming out about Wuhan and, you know, these other areas getting affected, I started, you know, texting him and calling him, and we were communicating about it. And he definitely let me know that this was, you know, a really, really big, really big problem, maybe bigger than what we were being kind of led to believe. So that was kind of my little inside line, because, you know, I was kind of hearing it certainly secondhand, but, or even third hand potentially, but I felt like I was getting sort of some very, very good information from that. The second reason is because my husband and I do read a lot of scientific journals, and some of the articles that were being published about what was going on in Wuhan, it was kind of easy to see how this could really, really explode if you, you know, understand some of the basic principles about infectious diseases and especially viruses. And so we, you know, I remember when this kind of all first was getting going, maybe mid-February, late February, early March, really trying to think ahead about how this is going to change our lives, our work, and trying to prepare for it. But of course, what you kind of learn along the way is that there's really no way to actually prepare for it. I mean, you can think about it all you want. You can come up with plans. You can come up with ideas. But until you're living it, until you're living quarantine and you're dealing with, you know, all the issues with our patients in the hospitals and seeing what actually happens, I'm not sure you can really totally prepare for all of those things. But it's good to think through them if you can. So we tried as best as we could to do that, which, yeah, I think it was around the end of February, early March, when we were like, oh, this is going to be a really, really big problem. And of course, you know, it is, and it was, and it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine it must have been frustrating to kind of know or really have an inside sense of the enormity of it to some degree, and to see how slow we were to really take it seriously. By we, I mean as a country.
Yeah, and it's hard to know, of course, what, you know, really happened during the outbreak in China. We weren't given totally accurate information, for better or for worse, whether that was intentional or not. You know, I don't want to comment about that kind of stuff. There's a ton of conspiracy theories about that, but we don't have to go there. Mm-hmm. But knowing just kind of how quickly this could get out of control, and the fact that we weren't really responding to that possibility was frightening. And so I think that we were definitely late to do, to implement some of the things we needed to implement, but we did manage to significantly slow the curve. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say at least in Connecticut, none of our hospitals were ever so overwhelmed to the point where we did not have what we needed. We were running low on some supplies, and we certainly expanded our capabilities in certain areas with, you know, entire floors being made COVID floors, the, you know, entire ICUs being made COVID ICUs. But, you know, we never got to the point like Italy. So I'm thankful for that. So I think that, you know, the maneuvers that were put into place did absolutely slow things down 100%.
So, you know, when you say the ER was turned into entirely COVID and, you know, floors were converted into COVID, which is true at many, many hospitals, this is really why I wanted to talk to you, because you're a breast surgeon. And as we know, cancer stops for no one. And I've been so haunted since the beginning of the pandemic by the idea that there were people who were waiting for surgery, or, you know, my own husband was sick last year, and I thought, my God, what if it had been now? And what would have happened to him? And so I'm wondering what these months have been like for you in terms of, you know, and you're also the mother of young kids, and going to the hospital, seeing patients, continuing to perform surgery. What has it been like?
It was very challenging. You know, a lot of us were kind of making things up as we went along, but obviously with, you know, tremendous thought and experience and good ideas. But ultimately, we were really making things up. So what I mean by that is, for example, at a certain point, our operating rooms were really no longer available for, you know, taking patients to the operating room who weren't about to die or have some terrible, you know, thing going on. If they had a diagnosis of cancer, a lot of times for our breast cancer patients, those patients can often take a medication as some kind of treatment before going to the operating room. So there were specific criteria that we developed in conjunction with Memorial Sloan Kettering and a whole host of other cancer programs that were doing this to say that if somebody was coming in with a new diagnosis of breast cancer, if they had the ability to take medicines first and stay out of the operating room, then that's what we did. And so there were women who would come to my office in the midst of this crisis. First of all, hear the news that they had a breast cancer, which is devastating in and of itself. And then to be told, I'm so sorry, but we can't operate right now. It's not possible. But, you know, we're not going to let it go untreated. We're going to treat you with medication first as sort of a stopgap. And it's totally acceptable to do this. It's recommended in certain situations. But, you know, it's not our usual pathway. And it was really, really tough for my patients to hear that. And I think that they just felt even more isolated and alone and scared because they weren't going to at least be able to get this thing out of their body. You know, that's what any woman wants when they have breast cancer is just get it out of me. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do that. It was a scary time for them. So finally, when we were able to, you know, open back up a little bit and slowly get people back, they were just, you know, so grateful for that, to be able to finally, you know, go through the surgery, even though nobody wants surgery. They were just almost, you know, calling every day saying, is it safe? Can I come back? Mm-hmm. You know, when can I get on the schedule? And that kind of thing, because they didn't want to go on living with that. And so I think it was tremendously scary for my patients. And I have a tremendous amount of empathy for anyone who has that kind of a diagnosis. And then combine that with what we're all going through right now, it was so hard. So, you know, part of my practice is almost as like a therapist, mm-hmm. I would say. And I really, you know, I bond with my patients, I connect with them. And I think that especially for women who are diagnosed in this time, they just need a lot of extra support. So that's what, you know, we were able to do.
How long has it been now since you've been able to be back in the OR?
Let's see. I think we started doing cases again around, say, about 3-4 weeks ago, something like that. So there was definitely a backlog. There were a number of surgeons in my group, and we were all keeping track of how many patients who were on the list who needed to be scheduled. And we were kind of slowly working through, but we just want to get them on as soon as possible, but you have to do it in a safe way. So there were some patients who almost wanted to see what someone else's experience was first before they came in. And then once you see that what we're doing in the actual operating room is we're being very, very cautious. There's a lot of restrictions, not a lot of visitors allowed. Everyone has to have a COVID test. I mean, the patients do. Prior to having surgery. So there's a lot of precautions that we're taking. And of course, everyone is wearing a mask, including all of the nurses, all of the doctors, all of the, you know, assistants and everyone. So it is safe, I think, to come in and have these procedures done, but it's a different ballgame right now.
I'm curious if you have anything to say about like what this brings out in people, this crisis on top of crisis, the anxiety. There are those who are, you know, terribly anxious and want to get it out and want to take action. And then there are, you know, all of those who are sort of holding those people and those stories and that anxiety, the nurses, the doctors, the staff. Are you seeing anything in people, like any quality of, just anything at all that feels new to you or different to you or heightened during this time?
I think what I have seen in my patients, which I do often, I see this to some degree, but I think you're right that it's sort of heightened right now, is just this sense of strength, to be honest, and resilience. You know, I tell my patients, you know, okay, we can do your surgery, but here's the deal. You know, you're going to have this very unpleasant test 5 days beforehand, because I don't know if you've experienced it, but it is not a fun test to have a COVID test. Mm-hmm. That swab is very uncomfortable. But you're going to have this test. You're not going to be able to have a family member with you at all. It's basically curbside drop-off. And when the procedure is done and you've woken up from anesthesia, we bring you back out to get in the car. I mean, you know, no one can be at your side. These are all very different things than what we're used to. You know, we're used to sort of the comforts of trying to have people have as pleasant an experience as possible when they're having surgery, which is not pleasant. And we can't offer those things. So what I've seen in my patients more, even more so than usual, is this sense of, you know, okay, I get it. I know why you guys are doing this. Let's get it done. I can do this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's inspiring, because I can't imagine being on the other side of the table. It's really hard what they're going through, mm-hmm. and compounded with, you know, being told that they're going to be alone. You're going to be wearing a mask. Everyone's wearing a mask. You can't even see, you know, the sympathy on somebody else's face. It's definitely made tougher for them, but you know, they show up, they get it done. They're grateful. They go home. And I think it's just a show of force for them. It's they're incredible women who have done this during this time.
That's so good to hear and inspiring. I think a lot of people listening are having this thought, you know I'm overdue for all kinds of checkups and annual screenings. People aren't jumping to go see the doctor for just regular routine reasons. What are you seeing now, and what are your thoughts, and like, what are you telling people about, we're not in a normal time and we don't know what that's going to look like, and yet in some way or another life also still has to go on in some safe way?
Right. What's scary for me as a breast surgeon is that I know that there are a number of breast cancers every week that, if hours had been usual and screening mammograms had been going on, I would have been seeing those patients. With screening mammograms and ultrasounds and everything shut down for that period of time, all of those women, it's not like their breast cancers didn't go away. They just haven't been diagnosed yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is what frightens me, that there is this subgroup of women who have yet to come back for their mammogram. And they would have been diagnosed had they been able to get their mammogram a couple months ago, but it was completely shut down because it wasn't really, you know, safe to come in. And so those are the women who, you know, I will end up seeing at some point in the next month or two. That said, a couple of months in the breast cancer world in terms of a diagnosis often does not change overall prognosis very much. So I don't want people to freak out that a couple of months has set them back. But I would absolutely encourage women to get to their doctor's appointments for, you know, their regular checkups, because the doctor's offices often are kind of the safer places to be. I've had patients who I've seen in the office in the past few weeks. Everyone's wearing masks. We are wiping everything down in between patients. And they've told me that they feel safer in my office than they do at Target.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be right.
I would imagine, yeah.
So I think it's safe to, you know, come out and do those things, because you can't forget about your health.
Yeah, no, that's really important for everybody to hear. So my last question for you is one that I ask all of my guests, because I think it's something we all need during this time, which is, what's bringing you hope?
Let's see. There's a lot of things that bring me hope. One of the greatest things that has come out of this is that even with me continuing to work and my husband continuing to work, we have spent a significant amount of time, more so than we usually do, with our children. And watching them kind of go through this and also show that resilience and understand that this is serious thing. It's serious business, but that, you know, it's something that will pass. And seeing their friends and neighbors do what's right, you know, social distancing and wearing masks, watching them and interacting with them and spending more time with the kids, that honestly has brought me, I think, the most hope, because in some ways, I think people get very depressed about this world and, you know, what things are coming to and how terrible some things are. And that shouldn't be ignored. Those kind of feelings shouldn't be ignored. But I also think that there's been so many, you know, positive things that have come out of this, where people have, you know, cut down on their commutes and done a lot of stuff remotely and saved some of that time and gotten to spend more time at home with their kids. So that's really what I kind of hang on mm-hmm. And try to focus on, because, you know, we all work a little bit too much, I think, and overextend ourselves. At least I know I do. And so getting to, you know, have a little bit of that time back and spending it with the family, I think, is really the most gratifying thing that that I've experienced over the past few months.
Yeah. No, that's lovely. And I relate. Even with my college boy, I relate. So this has been wonderful and really, really informative and important for people to hear. I'm grateful to you for taking the time. Niamey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and for sharing your experience of these last months.
Thank you, Danny, for having me. It's been fun. And I'm so glad that you started this podcast so that people can just get a sense of what others are going through and just feel that connection in ways that, you know, they didn't even know they were connected. So thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to The Way We Live Now. Tell us the way you're living now. We want to hear. Call us on, you might want to get a pen for this, 909-713-8995. That's 909-713-8995. And record your story, and we might just use it on the pod. Also, you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/thewaywelivenowpod. We are creating a community here, and we would love for you to join us. You can find me on Instagram at Danny Ryder. The Way We Live Now is a production of iHeartRadio. It's produced by Lowell Berlanti. Beth Ann Macaluso is executive producer. Special thanks to Tristan McNeil and Tyler Klang. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.